Evidence and Answers begins right now.
Archaeologists digging at Tal Hel Hammam in Jordan have uncovered stunning evidence that may identify the true location of Sodom. Dr. Stephen Collins has found that this massive ancient city met a sudden, catastrophic end, just as described in Scripture. Explore the facts behind this extraordinary discovery and how it aligns with the biblical account of Sodom and Gomorrah. You're tuned to Evidence and Answers radio broadcast with our host, Pat Zukeran. Pat is an author, teacher, and international speaker in the area of Christian apologetics, the defense of the Christian faith. Today, we will conclude Message 2 in Evidence and Answers 2025 conference series, entitled Blast from the Past. Here's Dr. Stephen Collins with the conclusion.
So that's where Sodom is located, not there where the traditional site of Sodom is located, the south end of the Dead Sea. And I will just briefly say that all the sites located toward the southern end of the Dead Sea that are sometimes identified on YouTube and by some people as Sodom and Gomorrah, did you know all of those sites? All of those sites were out of business, belly up, non-existent after 2500 BC. They all went belly up 2500 BC. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years before Abraham was ever born. That's an archaeological fact. So anybody that tells you that Babadra, Numera, any of those sites at the south end of the Dead Sea or Sodom and Gomorrah are just archaeologically ignorant. They shouldn't be. They're either ignorant or they're willfully ignorant, which both are bad. They ought to know better. And I'm calling them out all the time on it. And I'm always asking them, well, you know, you debate me. You know, let's get a debate on, let's film it and put it up on the internet. They won't. They won't because they know they're wrong. Or if they don't know they're wrong, then that's even scarier. But anyway, that's it. Now, I want to show you something. This is from the Sacred Bridge. This is the only historical atlas of the Bible lands that is usable in a doctoral dissertations. It's the scholarly Bible atlas. And I want to show you north and east of the Dead Sea. And this is a site map. This is listing all the archaeological sites in the area. But look at that area northeast of the Dead Sea that we just said where the cities of the plain, according to the Bible, actually belong. Why is it blank? Because people in the past, so many scholars, so doubt the biblical text and say that the cities of the plain are mythical that they didn't even bother to go look for them. But let me show you what the map now looks like, and this is in the archaeological literature. We're being asked to write chapters and books and all kinds of peer-reviewed publications on it. Tal Hel Hammam, Sodom, is now known as the largest continuously occupied most important city in the entire southern Levant. You didn't know that, did you? Sodom, wow, it's got big billing even amongst the archaeologists. Let me show you what this land now should look like. Should look like this. Over 14 major archaeological sites sitting in this area. The big dog on the block is that big circle. That's Tal Hel Hammam. And these are the Bronze Age sites. These are the sites from the time of the patriarchs in this area. And nobody paid attention to them or even knew they were there. There were a few people that did. But generally, the larger archaeological scholarly community totally ignored them. And now they're a little bit embarrassed about it. And basically what we tell them is, you guys didn't pay attention to the biblical text of the location of Sodom and the cities of the plain, and therefore you didn't go check it out and you didn't find them. But we did, and we did. And so there they are. Now, by the way, that was easy, wasn't it? I mean, how difficult is it to slice through the biblical text? Very simple. It's north and east of the Dead Sea. But what about the right time? What's the chronology of the cities of the plain? It's very easy to establish the correct time of Abraham. W.F. Albright knew what it was. Pretty much everybody that studies this knows what it is. But you have to pay attention to the archaeology to get it right. A lot of people want to put Abraham too early, and that's dangerous because of this simple fact. None of the towns mentioned in the patriarchal narratives, I'm talking about Hebron, Jerusalem, Shechem, Dan, Laish, Damascus. None of those mentioned in the patriarchal narratives existed between 2500 and 1800 BC. You can't put Abraham in that stretch of time because none of the geography necessary for the patriarchal narratives exists in that time frame. You have to get Abraham at least after 1800 BC, when all of these towns came back up, when Melchizedek has a Jerusalem, when Abraham has a Hebron to hang out in, when he has a Tel Dan to go to, all of these towns have to exist. So we have to get past 1800 BC, and every single archaeologist in the world worth his salt, no pun intended, I guess, worth his salt would disagree with that. You can't, because it's just a fact. So what's the right time frame for Abraham? The early Bronze Age, by the way, what's happening in Genesis 10? The rise is showing us the rise of urbanism. For the first time in the Bible, we're getting the great cities of Mesopotamia, Nineveh, Ur, Akkad, all of those in Mesopotamia. And then it jumps over to Sodom and Gomorrah and Admah, Zeboiim. And so we're getting all these great towns. What is this? This is the rise of urbanism, the first fortified urban cities in the world. And that's Genesis chapter 10. So the time frame for Sodom, since Sodom is mentioned in chapter 10, we have to have the early Bronze Age because that takes us back to the earlier history before the time of the patriarchs. And then we come to the time of the patriarchs and Abraham specifically in the Middle Bronze Age. And that gets us, and not just the Middle Bronze Age in general, but for Abraham past 1800, so we can have the cities that are mentioned in the story. I always said if we could find the city of Sodom, get a really good radiocarbon date on the destruction of it, we could nail this down and confirm this. And that's what we did. We have hundreds of radiocarbon dates from barley samples and other short life samples. And that's how you get it. That's what a radiocarbon date looks like when you pay $600 for it. Yeah, that's what it costs, $600 a pop to date a barley seed. Which upsets me because I'm a ceramic typologist and I already know we use the ceramics to establish the historical horizon. We use the ceramics to date the strata that we're excavating. So we already know what the time of the stratum is that we're excavating. But everybody now wants, well, what does your radiocarbon say? So it's kind of obligatory to go run the radiocarbon dates, but it never tells me anything I didn't know already. So it really irks me to have to spend tens of thousands of dollars to run radiocarbon dates, but that's what we do. So, but it confirms it because it puts the destruction of Sodom around 1700 BC, which is toward the end of the Middle Bronze II period. It's exactly where the Bible puts it. The culture of Abraham in the Bible only fits the Middle Bronze II period, not before, not after. And so it's a perfect fit. Now, so that's not too hard to get to either. The other thing is the right stuff. And what's the right stuff? Well, it's the archaeology of the cities of the plain, and there's a whole lot here. I'm just going to blast through a little bit of it. Here she is. So why do you call her a she? Because the Bible does. So here's Sodom. Here's Tal Hamam. You can see the big upper tell in the foreground. And you see in the background, there's another slope. See, just to the upper left of there, you see another slope that matches. It's identical slope. You see it? That's the lower city. The lower city has a big rampart around it, a big sloping rampart around it. It's about half a kilometer by a kilometer. And then you have the upper city, which is smaller on the inside. It's very Mesopotamian in style. And so here she is. It is the largest archaeological site in the Jordan Valley, and it's one of the very largest ones in the entire southern Levant of Israel and Jordan. Here's a typical day in the excavation. And I like to bring this up because it shows the size of this thing. This is the palace kitchen. This is the excavation of the palace kitchen. The palace of Sodom, of King Bera of Sodom, is just a little bit larger in footprint than the White House. See, we're not talking about small potatoes here. The kitchen at the palace is 5,000 square feet. The kitchen. 5,000 square feet. That tells you the magnitude of the size of this thing we're looking at. Here's some pottery from the kitchen. Here's Danette and I standing on top of the upper city rampart. And that rampart looks like that, but I don't want to spend too much time on that. That's the reconstruction drawing from the excavations of the city gate, the main city gate from the lower city. You can see a cutaway of it, how elaborate the gateway was. And all of this is done by Dr. Lane Rittmeyer, who's the world's leading specialist archaeological architect. And here's some more from our excavations. It's just building up the what the city looked like from the excavated materials. And here's what the city looked like. So if you wonder why the city looks like that, it's because of the excavation. We've excavated all sectors of the city. We don't have to excavate everything to extrapolate what it looks like. So we know where the temple area is. We know where the palace is. We know where the where the walls and the towers and the gates are. We know where the residential areas are located and administrative buildings. And so a very accurate reconstruction drawing can be made. Now, right time, right place, right stuff. All the stuff that's predicted in the scriptures happens at Tal Hamam. And it's not just Tal Hamam. We have the other cities as well, but I don't have time to talk about them. They're all there. And they're in a very tight configuration within a 7-kilometer circle with Tal Hamam smack in the middle of it. All right, the right story. So, well, the geography was fun, and yeah, okay. The chronology is okay, but how was it destroyed? That's what everybody really wants to know. How bad was the destruction? What does the Bible say? Genesis 19, fire and burning stone. Actually, it's goprit vayesh, burning stone and fire. So what happened to the brimstone? No brimstone. The word goprit can, in the later Iron Age, mean brimstone, sulfur, but it has a very wide semantic range. Abraham didn't speak Hebrew didn't even exist at the time of Abraham. It's a later development, but he spoke Akkadian. That's the lingua franca of the whole world in Abraham's time. And so he spoke Akkadian. If you look at goprit in Akkadian, what does it mean? Burning stone. Burning stone. And so, by the way, in the Bible, it's also translated many times lightning. So it can mean lightning, it can mean sulfur, but it basically means burning stone. And you can see how they jumped to sulfur because the only stone they knew that would burn was sulfur. And so, but it's not sulfur. It's burning stone. Well, listen to it. Fire, goprit, burning stone and fire from out of the heavens. What does that sound like to you? What does that sound like to you? Sounds like something meteoritic, doesn't it? It sounds like something came out of the sky. Asteroid, comet fragment, something crashed that came through the atmosphere going 50, 70, 80,000 miles an hour, went from the top of the atmosphere to the bottom of the atmosphere in less than 2 seconds, burned up, went from solid to liquid to gas to plasma instantly, exploded upon the ground at a very high temperature without leaving a, and these kind of events, if they totally burn up in the atmosphere, don't leave a crater, they just simply have a plasmic splash, so to speak, going about 15, 20, 30 miles a second on the ground and just splash over the landscape and destroy everything. This happened at Tal Hamam. We see it in the archaeology. Immediately when we got into it, and by the way, I just described it, so I'm not going to read this verse. We already quoted it. So burning stone and fire from Yahweh out of the heavens. This is not a volcano. This is not a terrestrial event. This is coming out of the sky. So let's look at it. It says also the next morning after the destruction occurred, Abraham, 50 miles away at Hebron, saw smoke rising from the cities of the plain like smoke from a furnace. How do you do that? You can't do that with normal fires. Couldn't even do that with a volcano. Wouldn't do that. It would be picked up by the west, by the easterly winds coming off the Mediterranean, blown into the eastern desert. This came out of the sky. When these events come in from space, and they're now very well documented, they suck space to the ground, literally, and then the destruction and the dust and the pulverization of material from the ground is sucked back through the entry portal in a vortex out above the atmosphere. So this plume coming from this kind of event would be visible from hundreds of miles away. And Abraham could see it clearly from Hebron, could see the smoke rising as if from a furnace. Well, in our first penetration into the Middle Bronze Age destruction layer from the time of Abraham, this little piece of pottery popped up. This one on the left. It's about the size of the palm of your hand, about like that. What does that surface look like? Glaze. Looks like glass. But wait a minute. Glaze wasn't invented until about 600, 700 AD. So I thought, well, what's a piece of Islamic pottery doing way down here in the excavation? And then I picked it up and looked at it. Oh, it's Middle Bronze Age pottery. It's Middle Bronze Age pottery. But the surface is melted into glass. In fact, the surface superficial glass flows over the edge of the break by about a millimeter. In other words, it was melted for just long enough for it to slightly begin to creep over the edge of the break and then stopped. So we took it and had it analyzed. By the way, that's the Middle Bronze Age pottery sherd. It is physically identical in every way. Those little white dots, that's calcium separation. The black stuff is carbon separation out of that glass matrix. The stuff on the right is trinitite from the first atomic bomb explosion in New Mexico. In fact, every scientist who's picked this up and looked at it, that Middle Bronze sherd, looks at it and says, oh, nice piece of trinitite. That's what they say. Why? Because they know it's physically identical. Well, we had this thing analyzed. Of course, when it goes into the scanning electron microscope or the analyzer, it tells you everything about it, right? You have a screen about that big, and the USGS geologist that was doing the look at this particular sherd, she has on the screen, there's this thing that looks like a basketball. It's like that big on her screen. And I said, well, what in the world is that? She said, that's a zirconium crystal. I said, okay. Well, why is it round? She said, well, because it melted. It lost its angularity. It got heated to the point of melting. And by the way, this is not in the glass. This is below the glass, about midway through the depth of the sherd, which is about a quarter inch thick. So it's about eighth of an inch from the top and away from the glass. It's not in the melted portion. It's below the melted portion. I said, well, what kind of temperature does it take to like melt a zircon? She said, about 2,500 degrees centigrade. Ooh, that's pretty hot. How hot's lava? Volcanic lava. 1,800 to 2,000 degrees, maybe 2,200 at the most. Well, this is not terrestrial temperature. This is really, really high. And then she goes to another one, and in the side of this one, there's little bubbles. I said, what's that? She said, this one's off-gassing. This zircon not only melted into a little bubble shape, but it also is off-gassing. These are bubbles. It's starting to boil. The zircon crystal is starting to boil. So what is that? What kind of temperature do you need to do that? She said, just sort of short of 10,000 degrees Fahrenheit. Oh, that's interesting. So all this stuff starts to come up, and then more melt material, and more melt material, and more stuff. And then we get the astrophysicists involved, and we get a whole team of expert scientists on Airburst to come in, 21 scientists from around the world, to start looking at this stuff and taking samples and taking control samples from around the area and all that. And they wind up publishing it. It's now published. If you want to get that, I can get that to you. The science is saying, hey, we have burning stone and fire out of the heavens, confirmed by the archaeology and the science. And not only that, the directionality of this thing is really amazing. We excavate the pottery. Everything is strewn in one particular direction. You can see here are jars. These are over and under. It seems like everything in the city at a moment became airborne, broke apart, and then landed. Not where it was, but someplace else. And these are jars full of grain that were literally picked up in the destruction and then deposited, landing in another place, being smashed. This little jar, these are pieces of a jar. These squares are 6 by 6 meters, about 19 feet by 19 feet, each one of these squares. So that's about 20, 30 meters of distribution, and it's going in a southwest to northeast direction. We now know the directionality of the event. It's coming in shallow through the atmosphere, going southwest to northeast. And here's that, and not only that, but here's that same southwest to northeast, but this is the vertical dimension. These pieces of this vessel are being found in the full depth of the meter to 2 meter thick destruction matrix, which means that that destruction matrix is single event. It's a single event. It's the biggest destruction layer ever in the Near East. Here's that jar. You can see that. Let me get closer on it. You can see some pieces of the jar landed where there was nothing smoldering, so it didn't get discolored. Other pieces of the jar landed near things that were burning and smoldering in the ground after the destruction. And so it gets all this discoloration and these different colors. And we have many, many, many vessels that we're tracking that were blown over large distances. We even suspect one now being removed from other parts of it by over 100 meters. Like a football field apart. That's pretty amazing. Here's a big saddle kern. This thing is huge. You can see it's a meter long. It's really thick. This big stone weighs about 400 kilos. And you can see here it is. But look at it. It's turned over on its side. It's got this grinding platform. But the grinding platform is turned. This thing is turned a quarter turn. Which direction? Northeast. That's a powerful blast that could turn a grinding stone like this in that direction. And so everything on the side is turned in that direction. And there's some more stuff, and that's the top. The buildings were literally sheared off at that level across the site. It's utterly stunning. Here's a piece of mud brick. Here's what it looks like when you clean it. Here's a piece of mud brick that's literally bubbling and melting. It's amazing stuff. Not only do we have bits and pieces of everyday life, we have bits and pieces of people preserved. Mostly anybody directly exposed would have been vaporized. But some of the individuals are in between walls and behind big walls. And this is not a whole skull. It's a piece of a skull and the upper dentition, and that was all. Here's the upper dentition of it. But we found pieces of people in the destruction matrix. And it's violent, it's horrible and awful. And anyway, this is the destruction event as it comes in over the north end of the Dead Sea in that direction, southwest to northeast. And maybe this will play. Here is a simulation of that thing coming in. This is all going to play out in less than 2 seconds. We're playing it slow. See the heat there? Now watch the heat on the ground light up some of the city below, and you'll see how hot it gets. That red is upwards of tens of thousands of degrees. Anyway, this is a computer simulation from one of the scientific papers. Now, why did God destroy Sodom? Why did he destroy Sodom? Here it is, from God's mouth to our ears. It's the only place in the Bible where God himself tells us why he destroyed Sodom. Here it is. Because they were arrogant, overfed, unconcerned, did not take care of the poor and needy. Literally, it says the widow and the orphan. And they were haughty and did detestable things before me. That's why he destroyed Sodom. But look what's up front. And we know what the detestable things are, right? We know what that is. But that's not the major. God says because they were arrogant, overfed, unconcerned, didn't take care of the poor. They didn't take care of the needs of people. They didn't love people. They didn't help people. And they were absolutely arrogant. They were absolutely unconcerned with people. And God said, that's enough. I will destroy them. When I read that passage for the first time years and years ago, I thought, that sounds like a country I know. Sound like a country you know? I think so. So what does all this mean in the end? It says, as it was in the days of Lot, so shall it be at the coming of the Son of Man. I think we've gotten there. Do you think we have? I think so. Sodom really happened, folks. Archaeological scientist, there's no doubt Sodom existed and Sodom really happened. What was it? It was the judgment of God. And after it happened, the story of Sodom becomes the principal metaphor in Scripture for the wrath of God. Jesus is coming again. And when he comes again, it will not be for the purposes of salvation. It will be for the purpose of judgment. And as Peter said, the elements will melt with intense heat. He's coming again, only this time it's going to be planet-wide, and no one will survive except the redeemed. Thank God. Thank Jesus for his blood and his resurrection that redeems us from sin and the wrath to come. Thank you.
Once again, we've run out of time. Thank you for joining us here on Evidence and Answers. Our goal is to bring you the love of Christ and to equip you in your faith to always be ready to give a response. If you would like to hold an apologetics conference or series of teachings at your facility, contact Pat by calling him in Hawaii. That number is 483-0586, or you may email him through the Evidence and Answers website. That's evidenceandanswers.org. Be sure to browse through our listing of topics on our site. We have everything from atheism to Zen Buddhism. You will also find articles and additional audio for you to listen to or download. An additional location to find Pat's messages is on YouTube. Look up Evidence and Answers and hit the subscribe button. To keep quality broadcasts like Pat's on the air, we rely on generous financial support from you, our listeners. Donating is simple. Just log on at evidenceandanswers.org. Evidence and Answers is grateful for one of our sponsors, the Honolulu Christian Church. If you don't have a home church and are looking for a place to grow in your faith, check out the Honolulu Christian Church. For service times, log in at honoluluchristian.org. Join us again next time on the air or online as we provide compelling reasons for faith in Christ. That's Evidence and Answers with Pat Zukeran.